Hi, this is Paul. As you know, last week was a hugely busy week. I am releasing the videos from the Quest for a Spiritual Home conference, one at a time. All the videos are great. I did a debrief. If the videos were great, being at the conference was even better. Almost everybody that I talked to was talking about the fact, when I asked them about the conference, you know, every now and then I'd get mention of this talk or that talk, and they were very much appreciated. But what really people really enjoyed was the personal interaction, the conversations, how you could basically get right down to the conversation. A number of people said the big thing was that there was like no small talk. It was like bang, right in the conversation. People found the conversations incredibly meaningful. What all of this, and then when I got back, I had a funeral to do, and then I had Sunday prep to do. So it's been a very busy week. What that's meant was I haven't had a chance to do any commentary videos, any of the monologue videos, the kinds of videos that I basically use to continue to process. And of course, the video world has continued, and I've watched a ton of videos since I last was able to do these. And there's a lot that I have built up and a ton I want to touch on. And usually what happens when I have that is I have this whole log jam of things I want to get out, and I don't quite know how to get them out in the right order. It's sort of like, well, here's a crazy metaphor, being pregnant with three babies, and, you know, you have to, they can only come one way out of the birth canal, and they all got to kind of be lined up. So that's my consciousness congress is trying to line up these babies to come out the chute. So we'll see what comes. And I'm usually quite surprised by what I put sort of at the top of the queue. And I'm going to lead off with this Douglas Murray on trigonometry. Now, in terms of the culture war, woke versus non-woke stuff, of course, trigonometry and Douglas Murray, they are all about these things. But what I really appreciated with this is that finally, in a lot more areas, a lot of these guys are looking beyond the woke, anti-woke culture war to the bigger issues that we, I think we've been talking about them in this little corner, but it seems like the bigger issues that are out there, we're starting to address.
And of course, the strange death of Europe before that. What are you thinking now, Douglas? What are you thinking about? What are you seeing other than all the stuff that we all already know?
I think the main thing that's preoccupying me at the moment is what we should be doing. Mm-hmm. I'm working away on something.
Now, pay attention that he said doing. If you look at my conversation with John Van Donk and Catherine, there's a big sense. So why do these conferences that we're doing? For me, it's similar to what I do with videos. Again, you might see my videos. Well, Paul is a content creator. The content is incidental. Paul has conferences. The conferences are incidental to the people. And as a content creator, the people is me trying to make sense of this world and doing the sense maker. The conference is you, listening to you, getting a sense of you. And one of the things that came out of this conference is, again, okay, we've got all the thinky-talky stuff, and you sort of have to do that. And of course, this world of screens is a world which forefronts the thinky-talky stuff, because that's what it'll do, similar to books. Books are all those words, all those ideas, but we don't live in that world. We live in this world in three dimensions. And so the things we should be doing, so let's let Douglas talk a little more.
The thing that's preoccupying me at the moment is what we should be doing. Mm-hmm. I'm working away on something at the moment, but the thing that started to really preoccupy me is, what would we be doing if this crap wasn't in our way?
Yes.
Mainly in the hope that I know you both share, that we can get it out of the way. Mm-hmm. You know, what would we be creating? What would we be thinking about? What are the things that are out there that should be bothering us, that we can address, that we can make progress on?
So in other words, getting beyond the food fight of woke, anti-woke, and saying, okay, well, let's get to the really big things. In other words, in some ways, this this imagined, at least for some like Douglas Murray and some in this little corner, sort of the imagined, this dream of this imagined utopia, which was never very well formed in people's imagination. Let's set that aside and let's actually talk about where we need to go or where we should go.
That's really what's sort of on my mind most at the moment, because I just see this great clutter in front of, particularly young people. That's what really strikes me, particularly in the US, but it's the same in Britain and everywhere else in the developed world. You just have this clutter when you're growing up. Now, you always did, but there's just additional clutter. And I think for a lot of young people who I speak to, a lot of them just are checking out of the whole thing as a result of that. And I think that we're at an enormous risk of losing the talent of the next generation if we don't start to think really hard about how the adults can clear the path.
And what are you thinking there? Because I've talked about the need for a positive vision of the future. Yeah. And as you say, moving beyond woke and anti-woke, because they're both destructive forces in terms of the energy that they direct. So what is the constructive path? Where, you know, what is that thing that we could be doing if we weren't doing all of this?
Well, I mean,
okay, before he answers, this is in fact, I see the key question that's bubbling up. And a lot of it's bubbling up in sort of these new conservative spaces. And these new conservative spaces aren't just filled with, let's say, traditional conservatives, people that have always been conservative, certain religious group, but now sort of also this post-progressive people. I'd say I'd count myself in that. People who might have been sort of IDW. People who, everybody realized that this trajectory that wokeism followed was just not going to lead to a good place. They realized that even though modernity is receding, what had been known as postmodernity, well, that wasn't showing a way forward. So there's a real grappling with what's going on here. Paul Kingsnorth did a video on Unheard, What Is There Left to Conserve? And on one hand, it's classic Paul Kingsnorth. He hits all the themes he usually does, but it very much deals with this question of, okay, conservatism, well, what exactly are you trying to conserve? What is there to conserve? What is left to conserve? What should be conserved? Now, Murray is obviously a conservative in many respects, but he's a rather strange one, at least for many religious people, because again, he's a gay man that is openly gay, and so you've got that out there. And so what we have right now, again, are a lot of, he's not sort of a traditional Englishman with a wife and children and all of that. And so we have all of these people that are sort of boundary, border figures that are sort of on both sides.
It's obviously different for everybody. I mean, you know, if you're a comedian, you make people laugh. If you're a writer, you write the things you need to write. I actually try very consciously, I've tried throughout my career to do this, to roughly balance what I write as doing like stuff that I hate and I'm attacking and stuff that I love and I want to actually defend and write about and do something with. It's very hard to get the proportions right. and we all get caught on that first one a bit too much, I think. But yeah, writers should write. You know, coders should code. But the main thing is in innovation and in thinking and in coming up with new ideas, you know, is there so much time spent on this unwinnable game that we've spoken about before, the unwinnable game of hierarchies, of intersectionalism and all this sort of thing. And it hasn't yet got anyone anywhere. Mm-hmm. But imagine if that amazing amount of energy and insight and ability was actually directed onto something. You know, I mean, and people have their own answers, as I say. I mean, Elon Musk's answer is, you know, we should go to Mars. And if you say to Elon, well, why? He'll say, you know, I think we should have a reason to get up in the morning. Mine is that I'd like to go to Mars. Mm. That's not particularly my thing when I get up in the morning. I mean, I'd be like Philip Larkin said about going to China. I wouldn't mind as long as I could come back the same day. But I admire him, for instance. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I admire him is I admire somebody who realizes that. You've got to have a reason to get up in the morning. There has to be a vision. There has to be something you're going to do, something you're going to conquer. And the other thing to say about that is that the great temptation is to say, well, the conditions aren't optimal. You know, there's this in my way, there's that, there's the other. And I'm not discounting for a moment that there are problems. There are problems of young people accruing capital, that's a big one. We've talked about before getting on the housing ladder, owning property, all sorts of things, rewarding investment, rewarding savings, rewarding prudence, all sorts of things that definitely could be addressed better. But I've become very fond of a sermon that C.S. Lewis gave at the University Church in Oxford in the autumn of 1939, and I've quoted quite a lot recently in speeches. He said there that he said,
I'd like to hear him quote this in speeches. So all of you out there, if you've heard him quote it in speeches, leave a comment so I can find exactly which sermon. Is he talking about the weight of glory? That was a little bit later. I'm really curious what he's referring to, and he doesn't flesh it out.
He says the conditions at the moment aren't optimal. a great example of British understatement.
Yeah.
But he says the conditions at the moment are not optimal, but they never were. Mm. He says human life was always lived on the edge of a precipice. And if our ancestors had put off the search for truth or beauty until such a time as conditions were optimal, the search would never have begun. Mm. And that is a very important thing for anyone who's watching, particularly who's young and starting off. That's a very important thing to realize. It wasn't always precisely like this, but in some general way, it's always been like this. Mm-hmm. There's always been things in your way. The question is whether or not you can get over them.
Douglas, isn't there another thing here that all of us who are attempting to chart a sane path through this are coming up against, which is, part of the idea of liberalism was throwing off the shackles of the shoulds and the oughts,
yeah,
right? And we've now come to a point where people like you and people like us want to say there are some things that you can do that will, generally speaking, on our...
Okay, and again, so we talk about the recession of modernity, and because modernity and liberalism are so thoroughly connected, we deal now with, okay, what about liberalism? And the space has been quite fraught with this. If you remember the early days of the IDW, Jordan Peterson identifying as a classical liberal. Is Jordan still there? He seems to be spending more and more time politically, although that's not entirely fair because, of course, if you look back into Jordan Peterson's biography, he began as an interest in politics and then went to psychology, which makes sense in terms of swimming upstream. Yet, okay, what about liberalism? Where does liberalism go? And again, that a number of you are waiting for me to talk about Tim Keller's death. And I do want to make a video with respect to that. Tim Keller's death happened while I was at the conference. I've read a few pieces about this. I've got my own thoughts about Tim Keller and how he fits in, but I don't really feel that they're mature yet. That will come. Okay, that will come. But that one video clip that I've played a number of times of Tim Keller talking about liberalism and how this works. And of course, modernity, liberalism, Protestantism, they're all bound up together. So this is what I think is the big conversation.
Average, make your life better, right? And we've now come to a point where people like you and people like us want to say there are some things that you can do that will, generally speaking, on average, make your life better, right? But we've lost the vocabulary to be able to say it in a way that that works. And so we are now in a position where we're afraid to say, like, it's hard to say, you know, generally speaking, for most people, family will be a good thing,
yeah,
right? But
for
the
sure.
moment you say that, then you're demonizing yeah. people.
What about people who don't have families? What about women who can't have babies?
And so on. And any area of life where you look at, that is the position we're now in. And that's why I think we're struggling to articulate that positive vision, because we're now all in a position where we can't really say, here's 10 things you can do to make your life better and to contribute to society, because we're all worried about being seen and being attacked for saying, you know, this is what you should do. Oh, you want women back in the kitchen, or you want, you know, the gays back wherever the gays were. All of that.
In the bathroom.
Where they belong, no.
I mean, two observations. Firstly, what you describe about the state of liberalism is something which John Gray, who I'm a sort of sometime admirer of, but he did write a very fine essay some years ago. He's sort of one of the students of Isaiah Berlin, who maybe a successor even to Berlin, if Berlin had one. He wrote a very important essay some years ago now called Modus Vivendi about the two different types of liberalism. It's a slight play on Isaiah's two concepts of liberty, but the two ideas of liberalism was firstly the idea of liberalism as an organizing principle, which organized it and then left people alone. The second form of liberalism is the sort of rampaging, always wanting to go forward liberalism, always seeking fights, always seeking a campaign, as it were. And this is one of the...
Again, this is roughly what Keller taught. Gosh, I just really got to play it so that it's salient.
I have some atheist friends who admit this. Say the thing that actually held us together was not freedom of speech, freedom of association, you know, using our reason. What held us together was like 80% of the population went to either a Catholic or a Protestant church. They actually went. And that even though, like, you know, the liberals and conservatives in Congress were arguing over taxes or unions, but they would never argue over same-sex marriage. They all thought it would be a horrible thing. In other words, everybody was a nominal, 80, 90% of people were nominal Christians. And because they were nominal Christians, they had a moral base, and they lived with the illusion that we're really not a Christian country, we're a secular country. But the fact is they'd never really had to deal with pluralism using liberal democratic structure. And when real pluralism came along, we found out we couldn't abide it. And so now here's the first thing that happened. The first group of people that actually moved away from liberal democracy into we're going to impose our worldview on you were the progressives. They were the first people to start doing it. Rowan Williams, Archbishop of Canterbury, former, he calls it programmatic secularism rather than procedural secularism. In other words, it used to be the government was secular in the sense of being a neutral umpire. And said, okay, you know, we want to make sure everybody has a level playing field to make your case and live your lives. But programmatic secularism goes like this. Put it this way. In the 60s and 70s, even the 50s, if somebody wrote a book saying it's okay to be gay, that would probably be not publishable because it would be banned as obscene speech, right? Today, if you try to write a book or say it's not okay to be gay, now it's also condemned as obscene speech, except it's called hate speech. And what's happened is there was a kind of hegemony, it wasn't pluralistic, there was a kind of nominal Christian hegemony that really did run things. And when that fell apart, now we realize, well, who's going to get in charge of the defining hate speech and obscene speech? And progressives said, we're going to do it. And so what they actually have done is they are imposing a kind of programmatic, hard secularism. And conservatives and Christians have seen that. They say, you know what, you're not being neutral anymore. You're really actually pushing. You're actually saying you have to keep your religion totally, totally private, when our religion doesn't allow that. Now, by the way, it's the same problem with Islam. So they're going to have the more Muslims that are here, the more problems they're going to have there too. But the issue is that conservatives are pushing back, wrongly, I think, and are saying, yeah, liberal democracy doesn't work. There's a lot of conservatives saying we need Christian nationalism. We actually need to get, the state needs to be overtly Christian, overtly Protestant, or there needs to be, you know, the Catholic integralists say, that the Catholic Church should be the state church. And what they're saying is there's absolutely no way to get that moral consensus. We're always going to be fragmented. Liberal democracy doesn't work. And it is a crisis, because the fact is, as long as everybody was a nominal Christian, liberal democracy works, and it doesn't. We're not that anymore. Liberal democracy undermined Christianity and religion in general and created this situation where we truly are divided. And now the old liberal democratic proceduralism doesn't bring us together. We're just at each other's throats. We have alternate views of reality, totally different views of reality. And I don't have a good way forward. I mean, if you were asking me that question, I'm not going to answer it because I'm actually thinking it out.
And he didn't live long enough to probably give us at least his answer. Now, there are pieces of the James Orr trigonometry conversation that very much led with this, too.
These ideas are antithetical to the founding principles of conservatism and liberalism and perhaps old school socialism. But those people are really not going to get on very well outside of opposing something that's a threat.
Yeah.
So how do we have a positive view of the future that we can all get behind?
Well, we all share probably ultimately quite distinct understandings of human flourishing and the good and virtue and so on. And one of the tragedies of an increasingly polarized sort of marketplace of ideas is that we can't really have those conversations about the sort of differences in how we understand those kinds of questions. So, I mean, I think, you know, one's got to try to put oneself in the place of these let's call them just radical progressives, and recognize that by their own lights, they are doing the right thing. By their own lights, they've got a very clear conception of what it is to flourish as a human being. They've got a clear conception of what sin looks like, what moral
looks like
error
you.
Looks like. looks like me, yeah, very, very close to me. And one of the problems, obviously, is that a lot of that kind of the moral coding rests in often contingent, morally inert, physiological characteristics, skin color or anatomy or what you want to do between the sheets, which historically have just not been understood to have any proper bearing on what it is to flourish as a human being. And again, I think one should recognize that it's not coming from an evil place. A lot of, you know, the early champions of academic freedom and freedom of speech were from the left and championed the rights of minorities and wanted to expand the franchise and so on and so forth. But as things have developed, and I think this is where I would probably depart from maybe you, both of you, and let's find out, is that, you know, that this is part of the liturgy of liberalism, that this is a feature of liberalism, not a bug. Now, my sort of liberal friends will say, to me as a conservative, no, this is absolutely, this is not a feature, it's a bug. It's a strange aberration. It's a metastasis of liberalism. It's sort of freedom that's just kind of, you know, intoxicated freedom. It's not liberty, it's license. My suspicion, and it's just a suspicion, I mean, my position at the moment is that, you know, liberalism was always going to unravel this way. That there's something within liberalism that is intrinsically transgressive, that is intrinsically restless, and is always chafing at the bonds of conventions, whether it's social conventions.
Now pay attention to the language that he's using. He's, you know, some ardent materialist might say, well, he is personifying liberalism. Some of you who believe that there is above us, there are layers, just like there's the corn and the dog and the farmer. But above us, there are layers. And so liberalism has something of agency, and it's working and it's moving. And therefore, it has a telos. And so then the question is, well, are there basically two kinds of liberalism up there that one can sort of pause as procedural secularism, as opposed to programmatic secularism? Or is this simply the end of the telos of where this spirit is going?
Or legal conventions and so on. And so, you know, you imagine, the liberal has the sort of his sunlit uplands, right? That's the horizon towards which the moral arc of the universe is above.
Okay, the eschatology, okay, to use theological language.
I'm a great Martin Luther King. Is always tending. And the trouble is that once the liberalism hits its sunlit uplands,
the liberal doesn't become a conservative. You know, the liberal doesn't say, right, we've now got to conserve the sunlit uplands. The kind of emancipatory dynamism of liberalism is still there. And so they might ask, well, what about the 1.2% of the population of the sunlit uplands that would prefer the moonlit uplands? What about them, eh? What about their rights? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, right. Well, their rights are paramount. Right. And we must now reorganize the sunlit uplands to create a space that is respects the moonlit uplanders. And that means we can't call the uplands sunlit or moonlit anymore. They're just lit. Lit uplands. And so you get my point.
Now, what you're saying is progressives value change in and of itself, and they will keep pursuing it even if they've got to a really good place.
Sure.
That's what you're arguing.
That's what I'm arguing. And I don't think, you know, that I think is a plausible take on the dynamic of liberalism. Mm. I should say, by the way, that conservatives have the opposite problem.
Yes. Yes.
Right. So if the central question for liberals and progressives is liberals metastasizing into progressive, as I say, organically and naturally, is where do we stop? When do we stop liberating? When do we stop progressing and say, actually, we've done pretty well, let's just try and settle down and conserve these gains? The conservatives are saying, well, why change? Change? What do you mean change? We've got to conserve this stuff. No, absolutely not. And so there's a sort of flip side sort of dilemma for the conservative, which the conservatives...
And of course, you could just sort of watch Jordan Peterson on his trajectory, and he gets to a point, it's like, okay, we're done changing. You know, he, him, she, her. This is what Western secularity has. We have arrived at the end of history. We will stop transgressing or progressing, and this is the peak civilization, and we should hold it here and not slide into degradation. And no, one person's degradation is another person's eschatology.
We've always had, which is, well, you know, the world changes, our environment changes, culture changes, wars happen, one's got to adapt. But it's not in the conservative DNA to sort of accommodate change. And so both sides have these sort of, you know, reverse, you know, structurally kind of complicit problems. And so that's a big challenge at the moment. And so there are some who would say, look, we can recover liberalism. We've got to see this as a strange offshoot. And I don't want to say that, you know, progressivism is just issues directly, is just wholly the creature of liberalism. There are clearly other strands. I mean, there is a Marxist strand. There are certain hallmarks of the Marxist frame of mind in progressivism, the tendency to really see the world as split in two tiers between oppressor and oppressed. The idea that there is some revolution behind just behind the corner that is going to set everything to rights. The idea that there has to be, you know, that there is a kind of that victory looks like control of the ownership and means of cultural production and distribution of ideas in particular. That's true. There's also a therapeutic element, I think, in the progressive worldview that I don't know if that comes quite from liberalism, but what you're seeing clearly is that old school John Stuart Mill type liberalism, you know, that rests on things like the no harm principle, you know, I'm free to do whatever I want, provided, you know, my freedom to act stops, you know, my fist's freedom stops at your nose, and so on and so forth. I mean, what's happened there is, I think, quite an interesting phenomenon, and it's described by a chap called, what's his name, Nicholas Haslam. He's an Australian psychologist. It's called concept creep, and we're familiar with it. I mean, once you see it, you can't unsee it. But particularly the concept creep around language of harm, yes, violence, care, kindness, and so on, and it's sort of the positive side as well. And effectively what's happened is that Mill's principle, I think, as harm has become increasingly psychologized, and as you've come to the view that, you know, hurty words damage you and disagreement is just tantamount to personal assault, then Mill's sort of principle, liberalism can get weaponized and say, well, that means we now have appropriate restrictions on not just on everything you say, but really on everything you think, because restrictions on what you say will affect the way you think. And this is something we're seeing, obviously, in the academy right across the English-speaking world, and to some extent in continental Europe.
Some people speak in sentences, some people speak in paragraphs, some people speak in pages. James Orr speaks in chapters, and so finding a place to pause and stop is not so easy. Now, I knew I should have saved these tweets because, of course, when some poor rando on Twitter, speaks her truth and it goes viral because everybody is just aghast at the truth that this person is speaking, well, then they suddenly make their account private and you can't see their tweets anymore. I should have done a little bit more screen capturing because it was such an excellent example. I grabbed it for my blog. How morally complicated is it to attend a Taylor Swift concert? Before I left New York City, here is my thread on seeing Taylor this weekend while she is dating a racist, Islamophobic, anti-Semitic, overall problematic white man. While I don't necessarily owe anyone this thread, it is important to me to take my public leadership seriously. Until, of course, she didn't by making all of the tweets her public leadership. And she just went through all of the moral complexity of seeing this Taylor Swift concert. And it was just tweet after tweet after tweet after tweet of all the different aspects. And I thought, my goodness, the Mosaic Code would be, do good, not bad, compared to the moral complexity of seeing a Taylor Swift concert. And this great burden of this great new burden of bearing the world on your shoulders that so many of these people have. I'll have to see if I can find some of it. Well, so looking for it, and here's Caitlin. Hello, Caitlin. It's actually so important for public figures like, let me check my notes, Holly Stahlkamp, to take responsibility seriously. And I commend her for this 100-tweet thread about going to a Taylor Swift conference that, of course, goes hidden. Oh, yes, but someone got there first. I've spent the last 2 weeks trying to listen to as many marginalized fans of Taylor as I can. I was trying to follow their lead on how we can and can't separate person from the art. I don't have easy answers, and I don't know what I will do past this weekend. Some marginalized fans are choosing to keep engaging with Taylor's music at some level, and some aren't. I'm trying to figure out my place with my privilege. It is not news to me that Taylor is not a bastion of intersectionality. This is Taylor Swift, not Alex Jones here, people. Have you watched her Netflix thing? I did not call her a role model for my littles. Taylor's financial situation alone is enough for me to stand on the opposite side of her ethically. I want our government to tax the shit out of her earnings and to continue to vote to make that happen. Billionaires shouldn't exist. I've wrestled with attending her concerts this weekend and know that all her shitty, harmful decisions to date this man will impact my experience in ways that I wish I wouldn't. I also know the bulk of white women that will be there have not thought critically about being there. I often wish that public figures would simply talk about the private wrestlings they are doing with complicated things, even in broad terms like I am doing here. Taylor wouldn't have time to write music, I'm sure, if she... this just goes on and on. I am not saying that people who bought the full-price, more expensive tickets made a morally wrong choice. No, you're just going to talk them to death. Just to say that I know I talk a lot about money publicly, and it just goes on and on and on and on. Anyway, back to Murray.
The problems of describing liberalism, apart from the fact that it's a shapeshifter term. Many of us, I certainly am, believe in that first form of liberalism. Mm-hmm. Liberalism as a way to construct the social order, and then you let people do their thing. The second form is the more prevalent form at the moment, is always the noisier form. And it's the one that's most tempting, particularly to young people, because it says, here's meaning, here's purpose, here's... Mm. So that's the first observation. The second one...
In other words, Holly is resolving her meaning crisis by endlessly hand-wringing the morality of a Taylor Swift ticket, whereas previous generations would just worry about maybe premarital sex or something.
I think people just got to be a lot less scared. I mean, I don't mind saying, look, for instance, all the data shows that you're going to be much happier in your life if you're religious and a believer. I'm not able to be a believer, a literal believer in religion. But I don't mind acknowledging that all the data shows that the religious are more likely to be happy. Why does that bother me? Likewise, I don't have kids, but I'm not at all offended by the data that shows that, you know, having children is, for most people, the single most important thing that will happen to them in their lives, as you know. Why is that any skin off my nose? Why should that, I mean, I'm not gonna construct the whole damn world around my own feelings. And that's what people are trying to do. And I think we should be much less bothered by them. So what? I'm not screwing up reality or altering it or pretending to alter it just because you might be mildly upset about something. So what? I'm mildly upset all the time. Very angry and irritable and much more, lots. But I don't think the answer to it is to pretend that the world is not what it is. Yeah.
Douglas, one thing that I found very interesting.
The whole interview was interesting. Now, they usually end on the big question, and he really sort of goes right back to it.
Interesting
answer. Seems to me we're talking about most things other than that thing I mentioned at the very beginning, which is what we should actually be doing. You know, I'd love us to get onto that. I'd love ambition to come back.
Is that what your next book is about?
I'd love us to really focus. That's the truth of it, and work out how to unleash the real talent, mm-hmm. not the way we talk about it at the moment of unleashing the talentless, but unleashing real talent, or at least not keeping it down. What would we be doing if we weren't doing this crap? You know, it's broadly speaking what I think.
Douglas Murray, thank you for coming.
That's good. Now, there's so many directions to go in this. There's so much I want to talk about. Like I said, I've got 3-4 babies lined up there, and they're all in the womb, and I got to get them all lined up so I can at least get some semblance of baby ideas out there into the world. But I think King's North talk is very much in line with this.
Out. It's been a long time since I was in London. So it was Westminster Cathedral. I went in there, and then the Mass was going on, actually. And it was just the Eucharist was just happening. The body and the blood of Christ were just there. And huge place, obviously, you probably know it. And so I just watched that. I was just in there for 10 minutes. And I was just looking around at all these people, so many different types of people from all over the world there, in different ages and races and creeds. And I just thought, I was probably brought in here for a reason. It made me feel much happier. So I went in there, and then I thought I'd better get down to Unheard or Freddie's going to get cross. So I came outside. I've never seen Freddie cross, so I didn't really want to. So I came outside, and the first thing you see when you come out of Westminster Cathedral is this enormous glass sort of armadillo building, huge, horrible thing, with the big water stones in it. It's like the Temple of Mammon, right, opposite the Temple of God. It's very symbolic. And actually, that's what I want to talk about. So that was an appropriate moment. So we were asked to do this seminar with this question, what do we do when there's nothing left to conserve? Which is an interesting question. And
it's a very interesting question. And of course, is there nothing left to conserve? Well, I don't know that that's true. But it's the question basically asks, well, it's selection, it's relevance realization, it's choosing, because, again, the world is too complex for us to actually fully take in. And so selections must be made. Most of those selections are pre-conscious, pre-intentional, but there we are.
The answer to the question probably depends on what you were trying to conserve in the first place, what you think conservation means. And in a country like this, which has been kind of at the spear tip of the modern revolution for hundreds of years, there isn't much left. There isn't much left that the likes of, say, Edmund Burke would consider worth conserving, I don't think. We have this process.
You know, one of the things that I noticed when I was visiting England this past summer again was, well, I live in the great American West, where, you know, you have arguments as to whether or not there's anything actually wild or untouched here. Even the most isolated place on Earth, which is Hawaii, wrestles mightily with invasive species. The terraforming that happened, again, in the colonization of the Americas. You can read about that in 1493, Charles Mann's book. the United States was terraformed, started with New England, New Amsterdam. Europe basically crept across the ocean with its cattle and its goats and its sheep and its wheat and its rice and you know, basically took over. But in England, well, they've been a great number of people in a small little island for a very long time indeed.
Here and across the world that I've called elsewhere a great unsettling. It's great, sort of tearing up by the roots of almost everything. So I thought, what would people be trying to conserve? And there are a lot of people around at the moment trying to conserve or defend this thing called the West, right? We all want to defend the West or conserve the West. And the notion that the West is in decline or it's collapsing or it's dying or it's even committing suicide is reaching a kind of a crescendo everywhere. All these kind of chickens of modernity that the West created and unleashed into the world all coming home to roost back here. So maybe we're talking about conserving the West. But then if you want to conserve the West, you have to know what it is. So what is this West? West of what? Why are we talking about that? And I thought, if you want to talk about the West or conserving the West or the culture of the West, whatever that even is, you have to tell a story about it. You have to revisit the origin story of the West. And going back into that church made me think about that. And you all know the origin story of the West. It's a good story. Like all the stories, it begins in a garden, right? You have a garden, the beginning of time. And in this garden, you have everything that's alive. You have the humans, the most recent thing that's been created, and you have all the animals and all the birds and everything else. And you have a plant-based...
No, he'll go on, and he'll start. Paul is absolutely a preacher there. And watch the whole thing. The whole thing is good. These are the issues I think about at a conference like this, and probably the talks with John and Jonathan and John Van Donk and Catherine. Those are always stimulating. So much go through my mind. I'm going to have to go over the recordings of those talks. But probably the strangest moment was the tour of St. Andrews. And when I first started listening to Father Josiah Trenum talk, I thought, oh my goodness, this is a Southern California mega church. Now, mega churches are 1,000 and more, so they're not really at mega church, and I don't know if they haven't not built that. The place looks big from the outside, but if you're going to get 700 people in that place, they're all going to be like this. You know, there's no fainting during church because you just fall on the guy next to you. It's not that big of a room. But I thought, here's an aspiring megachurch pastor in Orthodox robes painting icons on the wall. Boy, does that give me a lot to think about. Boy, does that give me a lot to think about. And so we're at this point where modernity is running out, and some are like, no, we're gonna go, you know, whoosh up into the eschaton. But I look at, you know, all of the hand wringing about going to a Taylor Swift conference and say, If buying a ticket to the Taylor Swift concert is the most morally fraught thing that you are really engaging with, I really don't know how you're going to be able to live. I don't know how you can eat. I don't know how you can go to work. I don't know how you can house and clothe yourself, because Taylor Swift, that's, you know, just the beginning. What about the industrialization of our food supply? I mean, you can... we better be a little bit generous to Holly, because we've got concerns on our own side. This is Paul King's North on Grail Country.
Comes those limitations if our actions are cooperating with God.
That's the big if, isn't it?
Right.
That's what takes us back to what we were saying earlier about the consequences of the fall, because if you had 5,000 people and you had faith, you could do what Christ did. But if you had 5,000 people and you didn't, you would try to create you might build a supermarket or something.
Or you might actually if you had a city of 5,000 and you were under siege and all you had was you might end up like killing people off. That's what the machine would do.
Yeah. So,
whereas Jesus feeds everyone with what's there.
And I come back again and again to the endless preaching about wealth that Christ does as well. Endless preaching against wealth.
Right.
There's no compromise on that. And you hear a lot of Christians today who will say, oh, well, he's not really preaching against wealth. He's just preaching against attachment. You know, it's fine to be wealthy as long as you're not attached to it. And that's not what he's doing. He's not saying don't be attached to wealth. He's saying if you're rich, you're not going to the kingdom. God doesn't like it. You know, woe to you. And it seems to me, you know, I suppose I used to think that was just a kind of social justice teaching, you know, that it's wrong to be wealthy when people are poor. And I think it is that. But it's also, isn't it, a warning about the obvious spiritual consequence of that. You know, you're just going to rot yourself if that's what you're pursuing, because it's like you're building this golden wall around yourself, and then you're not going to see God at all. You can only see God if you throw everything else away. I mean, literally and spiritually as well.
Yeah, but I mean,
the whole conversation was, you know, it was really an excellent conversation. Of course, I'd had one event with Paul, and of course Nate and Sherry, I certainly consider friends. So, yeah, Holly's wringing her hands about Taylor Swift, and you worry about the machine and AI and everything going forward. And of course, the marble alone on the floor is, you know, millions of dollars into flooring into this one building. And I'm not playing Judas, saying, oh, that money could be used to feed the poor, because they're doing burials and, you know, they're doing all sorts of things there at St. Andrew's. I'm not here to criticize them. I'm just simply showing that all of these challenges bring dilemmas that we go forward. And here at sort of the unraveling of modernity and the split in the road of liberalism, we find ourselves needing the best conversations and the best thinking and the best praying and the best worship and crying out to God for direction and guidance. And this after just finishing the sermon that I made on Romans 8, where Paul goes into this most amazing speech. In the same way, the Spirit helps us in our weakness. We do not know what we ought to pray for, but the Spirit himself intercedes for us through wordless groans. And you can almost, I can feel those groans inside of me with respect to all of these challenges. And he who searches our heart knows the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for God's people in accordance with the will of God. And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who are called according to his purpose. For those God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be firstborn among the brothers and sisters. And those he predestined, he also called. And those he called, he also justified. And those he justified, he also glorified. What then shall we say in response to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own Son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also, along with him, graciously give us all things? Who will bring any charge against those whom God has chosen? It is God who justifies. Who then is the one who condemns? No one. Christ Jesus, who died, more than that, who was raised to life, is at the right hand of God and is also interceding for us. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall trouble or hardship or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword? Or wokeism or liberalism or AI or we've just added to the list, even if we're not terribly worried about the hardship or the famine or the nakedness, and we're more concerned perhaps about the persecution or the gun. As it is written, for your sake we face death all day long. We are considered as sheep to be slaughtered. No, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loves us. For I'm convinced that neither death nor life, angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus.
To go forward, liberalism, always seeking fights, always seeking a campaign, as it were. And this is one of the problems of describing liberalism, apart from the fact that it's a shapeshifter term. Many of us, I certainly am, believe in that first form of liberalism. Liberalism as a way to construct the social order, and then you let people do their thing.
We can recover liberalism. We've got to see this as a strange offshoot. And I don't want to say that, you know, progressivism is just issues directly, is just wholly the creature of liberalism. There are clearly other strands. I mean, there is a Marxist strand. There are certain hallmarks of the Marxist frame of mind in progressivism. The tendency to...
Then he goes on from there.
The second form is the more prevalent form at the moment. It's always the noisier form. And it's the one that's most tempting, particularly to young people, because it says, here's meaning, here's purpose, here's... So that's the first observation. The second one, I think people have just got to be a lot less scared. I mean, I don't mind saying, you know, look, for instance, all the data shows that you're going to be much happier in your life if you're religious and a believer. I'm not able to be a believer, a little believer in religion. But I don't...
And that just pauses and I say, I understand. I understand what you're saying. But I also believe that you must be born from above. And there are menus on the table, aren't there? I must, a friend of mine from the Sacramento squad was in the reception, looked at me, said, I'm still a Protestant. I said, I am too. And I must confess that I did not have Father Josiah's, the experience of Father Josiah's brother of going to an Orthodox church and saying, and then, you know, leaving Presbyterianism and going there. Although Jonathan Peugeot is for me the most winsome Orthodox explainer. When Jonathan Peugeot goes into a place like that and explains and then suddenly a lot of the trip ups that I have, I look and say, oh, okay, I see what you're doing. I see what you're doing. I understand the goodness of this. I understand the part it plays. It might not be for me. It might not be the part I play, but some of the reactive cynicism or dismissiveness goes away because Jonathan, you know, says there's this and this and this and this and that works this way and that works this way and that works that way, and yeah, so Jonathan is a very winsome evangelist for Orthodoxy, but I still wonder. I do believe that at the end of modernity we will be looking at. I think the church will again look better and better as an alternative for what's on the menu for society, as secularity, this sort of short-lived, diluted form of the faith, as that basically begins to recognize it can't hold you up. It really can't hold you up. It's not going to be able to direct you. You might wind up in a hole worrying endlessly about the efficacy of a Taylor Swift concert. And what I noticed is that's the exchange for worrying endlessly about all sorts of things that religious people have. It seems, again, just like I've noted with people who are angry, they look around for things to be angry about. People who are anxious, they always find things to be anxious about. People who wind up in these sort of spirals about, you know, pearl-clutching spirals about all these things, well, if they're religious, they're gonna obsess about the religious things, and if they're not, they're gonna obsess about Taylor Swift and her relationships. And again, this is Taylor Swift. This is not this is not Andrew Tate. So yeah, so maybe this is one baby through the birth canal. I've got more. I want to talk about AI. John Vervaeke just released a good video with Chloe Valdery. And the real video that I really want to get after is the Jonathan Peugeot, Richard Roland, video on nationalism, but it just maybe I just had to get this one out first. So anyway, I maybe I'll release this now. I don't know. Instead of waiting for Monday or Sunday. Anyway, leave a comment. Let me know.